tracks around Australia. Here's Inside Motorsport.
Hi, I'm Peter Norton.
I'm Craig Revell. Thanks for joining us once again on Inside Motorsport.
Well, Possenborn has wrapped up the championship and taken it out in, record time. It's congratulations for a very interesting Aussie Duck Rally for 2001.
That's right, yeah. We had a fantastic run, you know. This has always been a tough rally for us, and to win both heats and win the championship for a sixth time, it's just awesome. It's like dream come true stuff.
It has been an interesting year for yourself. You've been quite dominant in your WRC car, but I guess the talk now to change it to almost a Group G type of series would not be going down well.
No, I wouldn't be happy with that, and I think as the existing manufacturers in the sport, probably not that fussed as well, to be honest. I'm not sure exactly where we all stand with it, but there's plenty of ideas on the table, and we'll start to go through them and have a look and see what we think is the best thing and put our 5 cents worth in as well.
Obviously, your concentration now goes towards your home rally, the WRC Rally of New Zealand.
Absolutely. You know, we pushed on pretty hard all rally here because we want to be in, we feel in good form, and we want to get to New Zealand and do a good job because, you know, how we go in New Zealand sees how rallying in Australia stands. It's a great yardstick, you know, and that's what we want to see how we can do.
Now, when we talked about your last run at the Saxon Safari, we talked about the logistics of getting all the tyres, and you'd been using a fair few wet weather tyres. I imagine you, the brand new wet weather tyres you got since last weekend, you've gone through them again this weekend.
Yeah, no, actually the tyre wear wasn't too bad, and we only used six tyres three sets for the event, so they went off pretty well, and we the ones we got in were just bang on. They worked perfectly in that long 40 kilometre stage. We managed for a huge amount of time, so we were very, very happy with the decision we made there.
For yourself, was there any components in this rally you were testing that you want to use at Rally New Zealand but hadn't used before?
No. We were sort of checking our setup, I suppose you could say, for Rally New Zealand and everything else, because we had, you know, that's how we run the car all year. We really like it as it is, and we just wanted to get used to it and do miles in the car so that we're bang on and ready for Rally New Zealand. And then when World Championship guys, when we come up alongside them, they're the yardstick. And if we can get within a second a kilometre a K of them, we'll be stoked, because that's as good as winning.
Yeah, it is a pretty tough ask. And Richard Burns is certainly out there gunning for Rally New Zealand this year, because he realises a win there would put him back in the hunt.
That's exactly right. You know, it's going to be the all-on, full-on event for everyone, I would think. And it'd be awesome just to be watching, I think, but it's going to be even better to be part of it.
What about the proposed rule changes that we're going to see at Rally Australia in three rallies' time in the WRC, where the lead driver can pick his position on the road? What's your thoughts, and can that transfer back to even down to club-level rallying?
I don't think it needs to transfer down to club-level rallying at this point in time. And because most of the time it's done for the sport there, you know. But at that level, at the World Championship level, it's so close and so tight, and there's so much rides on it. I think what they're trying to do is pat people on the back for going hard. And what's been happening up until now is the guys are sort of being tactical for this couple of days, because no one wants to be leading at the start of the last day. So to encourage everyone to go flat out all the time, the fastest guy gets his choice. So if he wants to start eight on the road, that's where he can go.
Is it only for the fastest driver, or is it just now a case of first man chooses his spot, second man chooses his spot?
Yeah, first man, then second man, out of all the factory drivers. So the slowest of the factory drivers gets the worst position, which will end up being one on the road, probably.
Skoda or Hyundai?
Yeah. Probably, yeah. Now, Hyundai's are actually going quite fast now, so I would suggest that it's, you know, be Skoda or someone that has a mistake or gets a puncture or has a drama is going to be leading the rally most of the weekend.
It's going to make for an interesting battle, because you could come across a situation where someone's picked to go behind someone else. They're not quite as quick as them, so you'll see drivers actually catching and maybe even some passing in rallying.
I doubt that, because they're not that much slower. You know, we're only talking sort of a few seconds slower, probably, you know, 20 or 30, and with a 2 minute gap, I don't see that pass will be an issue, because in Rally Australia, it's so dusty, you wouldn't be able to get close enough to get past.
Well, Possum, congratulations. Six championships is a mighty effort, and we do wish you all the best over there in New Zealand for Rally New Zealand. And I guess one thing can be said, you turned around New Zealand's defeat last weekend and took another Australian championship back over to New Zealand.
Yep, and we're very, very happy. I mean, it's a credit to the boys and the team that work on the car, you know, to make it so it goes like that every time. It just makes it so much easier when you're driving.
The Formula One circus heads to Spa-Francorchamps in Belgium for the Belgium Grand Prix. Jonathan Ledyard saw all the qualifying action and he had this report.
Very much Colombia 1, Germany 0 this one. Montoya's energy, power, enthusiasm overwhelmed his teammate and the world champion by almost a second and more than 2 seconds respectively. All three played the waiting game after a trademark Spa downpour, but only Montoya found the drying, faster racing line with pole-winning zip, and this in a car lacking the modifications given to Ralf Schumacher to bolster his bid to finish championship runner-up. With his Formula One debut, Michael Schumacher is still without pole position at his favourite track. Hakkinen was there last year, but he'll start tomorrow from 7th. Coulthard suffered a season's worth 9th to compound yesterday's high-speed shunt. Even Frentzen's Prost beat him in 4th. By contrast, Jenson Button in 15th and Eddie Irvine in 17th went backwards in the dry, but all is not lost as Spa's notorious weather system does its worst again tomorrow.
So after the race, the drivers got together for their debriefing, starting with Juan Pablo Montoya.
Juan Pablo, you went out and only did 7 laps, but you used 3 different sorts of tyres. Can you explain the way you started on wets and worked your way down to dries?
Well, I only actually went through 2 set of tyres. We did the first run in wet to get a lap into, you know, we knew it was going to get drier and drier, so we just did a decent lap to get us in the grid. And then we had to really play completely on slick tires, and it really worked. You know, the team timed it absolutely brilliant, and I think everybody did just a fantastic job.
Now, yesterday you lost time when you had an accident. Today everybody lost time with fog, and yet here you are on pole position. Would you advocate in future less testing at the circuit?
No, I think, you know, it's a track that I know quite well and I liked. You know, this morning we were quickest as well in the dry, so, you know, it was looking quite promising. And, you know, my first lap in intermediates, in slicks, it was okay, but it was quite reserved, so I said I had to really give it a go. And I did.
Thank you very much, Juan. Ralph, you looked incredibly frustrated during the qualifying session. You were waving your arms about. What were you saying to the team when you were changing to a different sort of tyre?
I was waving my arm around. I can't really remember, but anyway. No, we were discussing what to do, and it was not an easy decision to take, actually. At a certain point, I mean, we still had to have problem with the intermediate tyre, and we had to go on slick quite early. With some still stayed on intermediate on the Bristol side. But, I mean, at the end of the day, it didn't work too bad. It's always under these conditions you need, you know, to have a bit of confidence that the car is doing well, and you need to have the clean and good lap, and then you're there.
Now, as the circuit was drying out, how uniform was it around the circuit? Was it wetter at the far end of the circuit, or was it fairly even the whole way around?
It became fairly even. I mean, on the main line on the straight, it was already dry. It was just, you know, in some corners, especially turn 3 and 4, it was for us where it was still a bit wet.
Thank you very much, Ralph. Michael, while the other drivers were changing the tyres on their cars, you were simply changing from one car to the other. Did you have one set up for wet and one for dry?
Basically, yes.
But it didn't produce the pole position, obviously, you were aiming for. Was there any particular reason? Do you feel that the Williams BMWs have a power advantage here, or was it a tyre advantage today?
No, put it this way, I'm the Bridgestone pole position man today. If you look, the gap to the next Bridgestone guy is quite big, and we timed it right for our situation. It looked that way already this morning, that when these guys went on dry tyres in sort of a little damp condition, they got good grip together. But, you know, with these tyres, they have advantage in one area, then disadvantage in another area. A race is going to be a long way, and it should be all right for us.
Thank you, Michael. Juan Pablo, back to you. Still aiming for your first win. Spa-Francorchamps has all sorts of weather. We've seen most of them this weekend. If you had to pick one weather sort for tomorrow, what would you choose?
No, definitely dry. I think the car is working really well in dry. Yesterday was a big struggle in the setup, and you know, had a good thing overnight, and you know, and really paid off.
Last weekend, the action was in Finland, where the Finnish rally drew a remarkable result. The Finnish crowd right behind Marcus Gromholm, who took the win in his home country. Greg Strange from the BBC saw all the action and left us with this report.
All three top finishers can take great pleasure from this result. Marcus Gromholm has finally won a rally after 10 months in the wilderness. Better, he's done it in front of an adoring and demanding home audience. Best of all, he's revived Peugeot's flagging fortunes in the Manufacturers' Championship. Richard Burns, who finished second, proved he could run faster than Colin McRae, at least over three stages. He scored 6 points to give himself a glimmer of hope in the Drivers' Championship, and best, he's restored morale in the Subaru Cup. And Colin McRae in third has scored points in what he regarded as his weakest event. He's closed the gap on Tommy Mäkinen, who went out on day one, and along with Carlos Sainz, he's taken Ford to the top of the manufacturer's table, tied with Mitsubishi on 66 points. Five events remain this year. All three drivers fancy their chances in New Zealand, San Remo, Corsica, Australia and Wales, as does Mäkinen. We're in for a fascinating autumn as this new look, exciting World Rally Championship goes from strength to strength.
Greg caught up with Richard Burns soon after the event.
We had a very big day yesterday, 180 kilometres being first car on roads that some of them I hadn't seen before. So I was happy that we got through the day with no problems, and then again today we were in a good position to fight right from the start. So everything came off perfectly. I had the right tyres, the Pirellis worked on this occasion perfectly, and we were very happy.
What's it done for your confidence and for the team's morale?
It's done a lot, because I think this is the best result with given the fact that Marcus was still in the rally and didn't have any technical problems. This was probably the best result we could have hoped for, and we got it. We had a fight with Colin at the end, and it was good to come out on top of that. I think everybody in the team is pretty happy at the moment.
Tommy Mäkinen's on 40 points, you now have 21. Is it unrealistic to talk about just the glimmer of a hope of the world title?
It's going to be tough to think about that, but the only way to win that is to start winning rallies. Even second places aren't really good enough now, so we need to concentrate very hard for the next couple of rallies and keep pushing and try and win.
Can you win in New Zealand?
Yeah, we can win in New Zealand.
And that, of course, will really put the game.
Yeah, that would help, but you know, if it only takes Tommy to finish second or third, and of course he stretches his points as well. So it really depends a lot on other people. Of course, I'm going to try and win New Zealand. I've won there before quite a long time ago. We're always very quick there. I'm just going to concentrate on doing that as properly as I can.
A win is long overdue.
It is. It's been a long time since Great Britain in November.
He also had an opportunity to catch up with Colin McRae.
Yeah, the game's on for sure. We're only 6 points behind. We've got five rallies to go, so there's no reason why not.
Was it ever possible to win here?
No, not this year, no. I mean, unless the three in front had big, big problems, there was no way we could win here.
But you went into today in fourth position, confident that something might happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's three cars in front, and there was team orders with Peugeot. Richard was obviously going to be pushing to try and catch Harry, so there's always something can happen in these circumstances.
We've got five rallies after this, assuming the network queue goes ahead. Where do you think you're strongest?
There's not really any disadvantage in any of them for us now. This was going to be the difficult one. The rest of them, you know, we've won before, so no, I'm looking forward to them. Obviously, you know, if it all came down to the RAC at the end of the year, I guess it would be a great fight between Richard and I, but it would be nice to tie it up before then, if possible.
Last weekend in the IRL, there was action aplenty in the Delphi Indy 250 at the Gateway Circuit, just outside of St. Louis, Missouri. It was an opportunity for a famous name to take the prize. Al Unser Jr. picking up his first win in 16 months of competition, his second in IRL competition since joining the series. Here's how the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network called the race finish.
Off of turn number four, Al Unser Jr. has enough fuel in the tank to claim win number one of 2001. Crowd on its feet as he wins the Gateway Indy 250 Mark Dismore with his best finish of the season as he comes home in second place. And what a run and what a gamble, JP, those two teams, both the Delphi Kelly Racing team and that Stars Dallas Racing team. A huge gamble. And we see little Al Sloan on the back straight. He may be out of fuel right now.
So, Mike King, a very impressive display by Alonso Jr. returning to the top step of the podium.
It has been some 16 months since Alonso Jr. has been to Victory Lane. It was more than a year ago at Las Vegas where Alonso Jr. won his first event in his third start in the Indy Racing League, but he emerges from the car today, arms thrust into the air, the confetti flying, and he is victorious, one of the all-time great names in open-wheel Indy racing.
It was, I tell you what, you know, the crew's the one that put me up front. The whole Gallus Racing team did a super job. The Star Superpack car ran awesome today, and excuse me, what can I say? I mean, we had just enough, and Rick called it right, you know, and that's why he's the strategist, and I'm the driver. You know, we thought it turned the corner down at Richmond, and it didn't turn out to be, you know, but this team just never gives up, and that's what it's all about. You know, you just got to keep trying and trying, and it's the crew. I owe it all to the Gallus Racing team. They're the ones that put me out up front, and I got to thank them for it. And I just hope everybody enjoyed the show today. We're first time the IRL has been to St. Louis. I think that it was a super race. You know, I've ran both cars here, the CART cars and the IRL cars, and I can tell you that I choose the IRL car. It's a lot of fun around this fast oval, and the racing's really close, so I hope the fans enjoyed it.
How many times has a dad said, "Gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen, start your engine," and the son end up winning the race, huh?
I don't know, but if that's the case, my dad's going to do it every time.
Seen Alonso Jr., the winner here as Gateway International Raceway welcomes Indy Racing for the first time ever, and what a big, big day for him. A big day for Mark Dismore as well as he winds up second.
I want to thank Delphi, and I want to thank Bryant and Firestone, and without them, I wouldn't be here, and man, it just feels so good. This is like winning. I probably could have out-coasted him by 100 yards.
But Mark Dismore could have won the contest if it came down to coasting off of four. Sam Hornish Jr. winds up third.
Yeah, we had a lot more breathing room if we would have won. I screwed up on one of the restarts and had it in third gear instead of second, and that's when Al got around me, and just really kind of disappointed. The last 20 laps or so, the car was running quite where we wanted it to be, but didn't have enough fuel to make it to the end of the race. Wasn't worried about the oil pressure problems. We were still fast enough to lead, but making that pit stop to get an extra couple of gallons of fuel kind of hurt us pretty bad.
Eddie Cheever had a good day as well. Winds up fourth.
It was a horrible day for us. We couldn't get the car working the way we did. Owen did a great job. Mechanics did great pit stops. And we were never, ever did we have a car that was easy to drive and fun to drive. It was really sad to see Buell's name get knocked off the top of the Infiniti. I thought we had our second win of the season. Here in St. Louis, he was running really strong, and I don't know what happened to him, but that's very disappointing. But I'm glad this place is over. I haven't been able to get this thing to run the whole time I've been here. Sorry, it got kind of busy. I got squeezed out and got knocked back about 30 feet, but it was a lot of fun. The racing was good. Racing is always good as long as that, what's his name? Sharp is not in the middle. We don't ever have any problems.
Oh, my. They keep stirring the pot. It's not enough that the poor guys can find already for these action, but Eddie Cheever, it's kind of interesting to hear a guy who winds up fourth and is right there with the leaders at the end of the race be as disappointed as he was at the way he handled all. Robbie Buell winds up fifth.
Frustrating. I mean, I don't know how long we can keep having this conversation with having a car that's capable of winning and we're not even on the podium. And, you know, when those guys all came in, they would have had to have another stop. So we decided to stay out till we had to make just one more stop. So we were good to go. If Beach were heading to crash, I think we would have won this race because then those guys, the other lead group, would have had a pit. But with the Beachler crash, that hurt us in terms of what other people's strategies were. Helped them, hurt us.
As we looked at, with Alonso Jr. winning today, through, even though it seems strange to say this, but through 11 races, we have had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different drivers win this season. So even though this has been a season dominated by Sam Hornish Jr. in the points race and Buddy Lazier for the last five events, we still had quite a lot of drivers visit Victory Lane, as consistent as the Pennzoil Panther team and Sam Hornish Jr. has been. It's going to be very, very tough. Keep in mind that Sam Hornish Jr. now has 9
top five finishes. We had four yellows today. Lap 40, debris brought out the yellow, and when everyone pitted, literally every car on the racetrack pitted, there was a collision in the pit lane between Alex Barron and Buzz Calkins. They were both knocked out. Lap 51, Chris Meninga making his series debut, spun up there in turn two. He was not injured. He was okay. Lap 128, Eliseo Salazar slowed and had to be towed back to the pits. And then Donnie Beechler, and that was perhaps the deciding yellow flag of the day because of the fact that it allowed some teams to get in for stop-and-goes that otherwise were going to have to stop under a green flag condition. That was the big one. Donnie Beechler, thankfully, was not injured.
The CART FedEx Series moved back to Canada this weekend for the Molson Indy, this time in Vancouver. And Alex Tagliani marked a great day for Canadians in this event as he took the pole position.
Yeah, I'm very pleased because the players team is working really hard, and you know, we have the support of the crew and the engineers, and when we're on track, we're trying our best, but the best way to thank my guys is to give them a good result like this in Canada.
The pole position award is now in honor of Greg Moore, who lost his life 2 years ago at the California Speedway, and Alex Tagliani was quite emotional about receiving this great award.
Yeah, I'm really pleased and honored. I got a little bit emotional there with Mr. Moore, but you know, we're racers, and we want to do the best we can for our team. And here in Vancouver, in front of our fans, be on pole, and also having a Pat beside me, blue and white front row, it's fantastic.
Second position is another Canadian in the Players Forsyth Racing, making the Quinella complete on the front row. Patrick Carpentier was also pleased to be starting up front.
It's great. It's a good show, and it's going to happen at a better place. I mean, we're in Canada in the front row on a street circuit. At the beginning of the season, if we would have said that, everybody would have started laughing, but it's great.
Marlboro Team Penske driver Gil Dieferin has completed another great qualifying effort with a third position, thus helping him extending his championship hopes against Kenny Brack in Team Rahal. Racing, of course, on Channel 10 Monday night.
It's very difficult to get a rhythm going. You know, we had a couple of good laps really on the go there, but unfortunately I wasn't able to complete them. I kept making little mistakes and losing time right at the end of the lap. So, you know, but I think the car is it's okay for tomorrow. We'll see how we get on.
A very busy time for John Davison, promoter of Sandown Raceway, and an exciting time for you. The 34th annual, the 34th running of the Sandown 500 is only a few weeks away now, and for yourself it is probably a great thrill to have the Procar division coming along and restoring the great race to its pedestal.
Yes, Craig, it's been a series of ongoing negotiations that I've had with the owner of Procar, Ross Palmer. He initially cited the idea to me last year about running a standalone event, and I said, why don't you do it with the Sandown 500, because Vesco decided it was better run elsewhere. And I said originally the event, when it started in 1964, and for many, many years of its existence, had always been a multi-manufacturing event. Everything from Studebakers to Ford Galaxies to Cortinas to Nissans to you name it have appeared in that event, and it's only really been, I think, in the last 7 or 8 years that it's been the sole domain of Ford and General Motors with the Commodores and Falcons. And he was very receptive to the idea, and so this is the first foray into it. I think it would be fair to say that we don't expect it to attract the same degree and extent of crowd appeal, or the number of people, more to the point, that the V8s will. But it shouldn't be forgotten, in 1991, when I originally ran the event for the first time, I ran it for 11 cars. That's all that turned up on the grid. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And I had an hour's edited highlights at the Channel 2, the ABC, at 11 o'clock that night. And I hung in there and persevered with the event, and always tried to make sure that the venue was very well presented and everything was clean. And the event went on and grew to the grand extent that it did. So the V8s have gone elsewhere. Why should I allow the grass to grow through my feet? So we've entered into an arrangement with Ross, and he's going to underwrite the event, and if it's successful, then we'll enter into a 5-year agreement commencing next year, and it'll be run basically in the middle of September, and it will continue to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Yeah. It's always a bit difficult, Craig, with motorsport people or any sport which is heavily reliant on budgetary considerations, which motorsport's obviously one. If you introduce event to the entrants or competitors halfway through a season, but next year the event of course will be scheduled when the calendar's announced later in the year, and they have 9 or 10 months to consider it and look for driver pairings, and I'm very confident the event will continue to grow.
Mm. As a promoter yourself of motorsport in Australia, you must have been looking at what Ross Palmer and Steve Betts, Chris Nixon, the Deniers have all been doing with the ProCar standalone meetings, because they have shown promoters out there and media out there that people are interested in more than just the two-horse race that Evesco want to trot out in various forms around the country. And we've already seen with Evesco that one of those forms should be shot.
Yes, well, you know, motorsport's been through an enormous upheaval in the last 5 or 6 years, and with respect, I don't think that CAMS, the governing body, really gave enough consideration to protecting events of some significance and stature. And I was very resentful, to be perfectly honest, that the Sandown 500 was taken away from me, more particularly, Craig, as I was the guy that actually got Channel 10 interested in the V8s. It wasn't Cochrane or any of his people. It was me that originally got them involved in televising the Sandown 500 in 1996. And I contributed nearly $100,000 to the production cost of that telecast in order to give them the incentive to get involved. You may remember early on in the 90s, they were involved in the endurance production car event that a guy called Vince Tesserero ran at Bathurst over Easter, and they sort of faded out after that, and I got them involved, and I was really very, very resentful of the way I was treated when the 500 was taken away. And so there has been, I think, a direction adopted which has really been to try and ensure that only the V8s get the majority of the publicity machine. But Ross Palmer's a very tenacious person and also a man of very considerable financial means. I mean, he's a very wealthy guy. And he set about ensuring that other manufacturers and other cars and other divisions and other people in motorsport have events to go to that are worthwhile competing in. And the only way eventually that he was able to do that was to run a number of standalone events. And it's a fairly gutsy thing to do because you're not always sure how they're going to stack up in terms of crowd appeal. And you always risk the weather, which can affect any outdoor event. But as far as I'm concerned, I think the 500 will turn into a very big event in the next couple of years as more people within motorsports accept and look forward to races where there are more than two manufacturers involved.
Mm. Over the years, of course, at Sandown, you've really been, since what happened with the 500, and we won't dwell too much on that, but since that time, you've really looked at events that have had a huge family appeal and a huge cross-performance appeal. Of course, the Eastern Nats have gone from strength to strength. You've got historic days there and the historic meeting coming up, I think, later in the year, which is another of your big meetings, which draw a huge crowd, or a good number of crowds. And with ProCar, the amount of different cars they're going to have on offer, it once again goes right across the board. People want to see a Ford and Holden, they can see it. People want to see a Jaguar or a Viper or a Porsche, that's going to be there as well.
Well, that's right, and it'll be interesting to see, but I think that this year it will take some of the entrants a bit of time to talk themselves into doing it, only because there will be some financial constraints that they may not be able to afford it, because the event was only really confirmed in July. But if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. And we're offering free access into the pits for the entire weekend. And Sandown has, as you correctly say, one of my intentions has been to make the venues very clean and user-friendly, which predominantly is attractive to families. And, of course, you know, I always feel, really, that one of the buzzes that a lot of people get when they go into an AFL change room is actually getting to see the competitors warming up, all the players, and smelling the liniment. Well, the same applies in car racing, that if they can get down and smell the fuel and see the guys working on the brakes and the mechanics getting ready and checking the tyre pressures. There's a lot of personality in that. And so that's the reason we make that part of our admittance price free. We include it all in one price.
Mm. Now, for the people who are getting ready for what is going to be an exciting period of about 2 months at Sandown Racing for motorsport fans. Of course, you've got that, or actually, it's spread over 3 months, isn't it? Because you do have that pesky horse race in the middle.
Well, the way, actually, I received a letter from the VATC in December of last year, basically stating that Sandown was out of bounds as from the first weekend of September up until almost the end of November, predominantly because of the quarantine requirements for the international horses. Because a lot of people are not aware that Sandown is only a horse racing track. They don't train there. They only arrive on the morning race and leave. And so it has become a very suitable venue for international quarantining. And there were restrictions by the quarantine people, which were compounded by the foot and mouth disease and so on in England. And this did create some problems for Sandown. But I must say that, in my opinion anyway, and I'm sure the VATC would agree with us, that the relationship between the car and horse racing people has never been better. And there will be some interesting announcements in the not too distant future about some initiatives that the horse racing people and myself are doing out there, which will cement motorsport even further. I can't go into it because there's some confidentiality reasons that I can't. But initially, when I took over Sandown, it was only ever renewed on a year-to-year basis, and that's a very difficult financial proposition to encompass because you just don't know whether or not you're ever going to get any return. It takes years often to make these events work. In fact, my experience in being a promoter is it takes 5 to 7 years to build an event. And it was really only about the 6th or 8th Sandown 500 that I ran that the event really started to stack up. Before that, it was always being compared to Bathurst, or there were monumental changes in the 1990s with the AFL, and they went to an 8 and played interstate matches, interstate or AFL football final matches, interstate televised live back into Melbourne, which they hadn't done. And so the Sandown 500 was put up against some very formidable competition, and in every instance, it came out stronger for it. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm very pleased to be associated with Ross and Steve Betts and Craig Denyer and the other gentlemen involved with Procar. They're very easy to deal with, and the morale between our two organisations is very good, and I think you should keep an eye on the Sandown 500. Held at Australia's greatest racecourse, Greg. Keep an eye on it, it'll grow.
That was John Davidson, the promoter of Sandown International Raceway, and that's part one of a two-part package. Part two will be played next week, and it's quite interesting to be hearing his viewpoints about Avesco and V8 racing and some of his comments about TV. Our next little piece is a package coming from the press conference that was held at Queensland Raceway, and where Tony Cochran talks a bit about TV and some of the deals that are coming.
Yes, he has certainly put all his eggs into the Channel 10 basket, thinking that AFL football isn't going to reign supreme.
Well, that's very much the topic of some of the discussion that was held in the press conference. And, well, you'll hear what he has to say in just one moment. But really the common theme is that Channel 10 are pretty committed to motorsport, and really it will be a case of time will have to tell there. And they talked about a few scenarios regarding what if, what that, particularly for some of the Saturday V8 racing, which will come up directly against the AFL telecasts.
It is going to be an interesting one. Just before, ahead of Tony Cochran, we do have some other news. Of course, Greenfield Mowers, you mentioned them during your reports last weekend with their suspension. It doesn't seem like a decision has been reached there.
Yes, a very messy one. It's always unfortunate when lawyers get involved, but it does seem as though for a successful race team these days you need good mechanics and good lawyers, as well as good drivers. And it seems as though Greenfield Mowers, a good family friend of McLean, have supported him for many years. But unfortunately the checks were a little bit slow in coming in recent months, which opened the door for them to put VIP pet foods on the side of the car. And that really upset Greenfield Mowers, and it end up in court, and it's still being resolved exactly who owns the car and what will happen there. So it would be very unfortunate if Canberra's Neil Bates misses out on a Bathurst drive because it's still tied up in court.
Mm. And, of course, one man who walked out of court finally with a check is Wayne Gardner.
Yes.
A former Neil Bates teammate. There's a consistent stream there, isn't there? Neil Bates and court problems.
Well, let's hope that Neil stays out of court himself, but yes, some of his associates have ended up in court, and Wayne Gardner, a very happy winner. You could say he's tickled pink, and a bit of emphasis there on reference to colour, because Donut King, they withheld $100,000 worth of sponsorship a few years ago because Wayne Gardner's Commodore arrived, his brand new car, with a red bonnet and Donut King written in white, and they were very upset about that because their corporate logo is a white background and the writing in pink. So they use that as an excuse not to pay. The court has finally found in favour of Wayne after a few appeals and messy type of stuff like that. Apparently they had not approved any designs. They hadn't provided any feedback to the race team. So that Wayne went ahead with the all red bonnet for aesthetic reasons. The court has finally decided that Wayne had every right to do that and hand over the money, please.
Perhaps he had a Coca-Cola bonnet that he wanted to use at the time.
I think most of his bonnets were always new out of the box because the previous ones were all pretty damaged.
Oh, you are a harsh man, Peter Norton. But as we said, the press conference from the Queensland Raceway in regards to Tony Cochran, I believe that it has some interesting ramifications to the Canberra race as well.
Yes. Just before the running of the 2001 VIP Pet Foods Queensland 500 last weekend, Avesco, who are the organisers of V8 Touring Car Racing in Australia, they held a press conference to discuss future TV rights and arrangements and some of the other pressing issues in the sport. Their chairman, Tony Cochran, made a few announcements and led the discussion. Here's what he had to say.
It's just coming up on 5 years since we went to Sandown, the old Sandown 500, and formally announced the intended formation of Avesco. And it's a bit amazing to believe that in 2 weeks' time that 5 years will kick over. Of course, one of the very first things that Avesco was able to achieve was a meaningful television contract. And it's interesting, every so often people forget, but it is only 5 years ago that we had a television partner who was a fairly lousy partner, to be frank, and things have moved on. Avesco and Network 10 have signed a new 5-year agreement to commence January next year. It's the biggest deal ever signed in Australian motorsport history. We are very, very excited about it. It guarantees V8 Supercars live national coverage for the next 5 years. It also guarantees us preemptive times on our national coverage so that we can't be bumped around by another sport. But it's the best of both worlds because Network 10, who are rapidly under David's guidance becoming the sport network in Australia, have also signed the AFL, including all the finals series, exclusively. And having now two of the top four sports in the country with AFL and V8 Supercars, it gives us some wonderful cross-promotional opportunities. Network 10 are leaders in their field, I have to say, internationally, but certainly in Australia, in their multi-view and their digital coverage. Many of you would be aware we've been trialling digital coverage now, courtesy of Murray Lomax and his excellent crew, for some time. It is absolutely fabulous, and as digital television becomes more and more available in Australia, you'll see firsthand just how exciting that is, and particularly for a sport like motorsport. Many of you would know now, but it's heading towards the end of its second year, we've had live coverage on TVNZ, the main broadcaster in New Zealand, and that has been an outstanding success, and we're achieving ratings that are rivaling rugby union, which in that country is almost like sacred ground territory. Coupled with that now, we've now sold off our television coverage to nearly 400 million homes around the world. The biggest of those deals is a brand new deal which commenced only 3 months ago with Speed Vision in America and DirecTV that shows our entire race in action on a year-on-year basis. starting next year, Speed Vision will also be showing our major events live throughout mainland USA. This year, we've signed a deal with Motors TV, which goes to 44 countries throughout the European region, to take Bathurst live. The first time ever in the V8 era that Bathurst is genuinely being shown live throughout the whole of Europe.
Mr. David White, Network 10's General Manager of News, Current Affairs and Sport, explained how the priorities and potential conflicts between V8s and the AFL would be balanced. Here's how he explained the future arrangements.
The introduction of AFL to the network will be a positive thing for the network and a positive thing for V8 Supercars. It'll give us a tremendous platform to cross-promote out of on Saturday afternoons. Over the next 5 years, starting next year, we'll probably have more sport on Network 10 than any other network. And the two really high-profile sports of AFL and V8 Supercars, I think, will fit hand in glove. What we'll probably do is play the footy in pit lane. The AFL are well aware of our agreement with Avesco. And as Tony said, this agreement with Avesco gives final say to the V8 Supercar calendar. But having said that, there will be, you know, some mutual understanding, and that's only commonsensical. To be definitive about your question, next year the Clipsal 500 is on the same weekend as the ANZ Cup Grand Final. That will be played at night, so we'll have the Clipsal 500 Saturday afternoon, ANZ Cup Grand Final Saturday night, Clipsal 500 Sunday afternoon. There will be no AFL telecast on the Saturday of the long weekend because we'll be doing the GMC 400. And I don't know how familiar you are with the AFL agreement with the consortium that now makes up the broadcast partnership, but it's a combination of 10, 9 and Foxtel. So Foxtel on that Saturday will be telecasting the Saturday game. And I have to say that over the course of this AFL contract, there will be times where Channel 9 have a potential conflict with something they may do. We may have a potential conflict with something that we may do, and all three partners have an understanding that we will swap games if necessary. We won't be telecasting any Sunday games, apart from if there was a Sunday final. That's probably unlikely, but the final series are at a time that are complementary with the V8 calendar anyway.
There was also some discussion regarding next year's calendar, and in particular there were many comments regarding the recent decision by the Western Australian government not to host a V8 street race along the lines of the successful Adelaide race and the Canberra race, which has had mixed success. Tony Cochrane had this to say.
The board have decided at this stage that we will not be going to Western Australia for the first time in 27 years, and we are currently looking at other options. I have to say that there are a couple of senior bureaucrats in Western Australia who have realised the problems, probably because they've been besieged by fan emails, faxes and phone calls, or their ministers have. And we have left the door slightly open until next Friday for them to try and reconsider their position in life. I'll be honest, I'm bitterly disappointed in Perth. I think the Western Australia Events Corp are a funny, unusual organisation. They can find money for nearly every sport you can think of, but when it came to motorsport, they suddenly it's not available. And I think the fans in Western Australia will speak up, and I think that we'll eventually have our day in Perth, but it's not going to be in the foreseeable future.
In light of the WA government decision, can you comment on how that has fueled the community debate in Canberra about the value for money of the deal? And is there any possibility of having a local area broadcast blackout to help individual promoters?
The debate in Canberra is fueled by a few idiots who just don't want to see the race under any circumstances. And they have no backup in government. We've got a 5-year agreement at Canberra. It's got 3 years yet left to run. We're not into blackouts in local area. We're trying to build this sport. They are desperate measures that desperate sports get up to sometimes in the hope that I'll get a bit of a live crowd along. We're in the opposite boat. Our crowds are up 8% this year on last year. Last year they were 9% up on the previous year before that. The year before that they were 11% up the year before that. So we're doing something right. And one of the things we are doing right is a tremendous live broadcast to everywhere, courtesy of Network 10.
It is clear that Avesco sees the future growth in the V8 series to be on the street events, both within Australia and overseas. Tony Cochran had the following comments about the overseas growth of the sport, and obviously it's very much applicable to the street races and the Western Australian decision.
It's just a question of time. It's a question of convincing people that our economic argument's a good one. Our television, international TV package now is starting to really resemble something that's very strong. And we will get there, but it's certainly not happening as quickly as I would have liked.
Also on the theme of government support for V8 touring car events, there was also discussion about the future of the jewel in the crown of Australian motorsport. That, of course, is Bathurst. Tony Cochran made his opinion quite clear.
I think you'll find with what we've assured the New South Wales and federal governments, if they come good with their funding package for Bathurst, and I sincerely hope they do, I think you'll find that V8 supercars will be on the October long week at Bathurst for many, 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 many years to come. Well, once again, I know I'm like a broken record on this, and I'm not apologetic for it. Every sport in this country, every sport, gets federal and state government funding to help their sport. When it comes to motorsport, in certain parts of Australia, there's nothing. And I think we've now got the attention of the federal and state governments through the Bathurst City Council. It's the second biggest job employer in the Bathurst Orange region. Now, if you're going to be a federal and state government, you're going to talk about regional development, you can't ignore this one. You cannot ignore it. And we've focused them on it. We've worked with them now for 6 months religiously on it. I've been a good boy. I haven't jumped into the press and jumped on anybody. And I'm going to continue to behave myself and be a good boy, provided I see some serious funding come for the Bathurst City Council. You'll see some big changes this year, and I hope that immediately after we finish Bathurst this year, they have to put a D9 through big parts of the place and we build a brand new Bathurst for many, many years to come. It's an Australian icon. It's an Australian icon. Like the MCG, spending $165 million to redevelop the MCG next year, we only want real small serve. Only 20 mil.
Tony Cochran, and well, you've got to really wonder about Tony Cochran. He's been telling people to bulldoze the place down and rebuild it for something much, much better. And then he says, we've got to have a media day when the Sandown 500's on. And, of course, Stephen Johnson's going to be running a Diablo at the Sandown 500.
Yes, according to Tony Cochran, there's only one form of motorsport in Australia and perhaps in the world, and I think that is a bit short-sighted. So it was interesting to play that sort of following the previous interview with the promoter of Sandown, of course, John Davidson. Yes, some very different viewpoints on the state of motorsport in Australia. And you know, Tony Cochran, of course, chooses not to address the fact that Bathurst is used once a year, the MCG. Our AFL fans obviously know that it's used many, many more times, gets many more people there, so the taxpayer gets better value for money out of the contribution towards the improvements to the wonderful G. And also other things there he chooses to take a rose-coloured view to, in particular the state of politics. I'm sure it will be a very interesting fight for the ACT government here later in October, and we'll see what happens at the other side of that. Well, I think we can be confident that the funding of the V8 race will be one of the campaign issues that both sides will argue about.
Yes, and we know who'll be for, and we're pretty sure who'll be against.
Yes, that's right.
And if it's cheaper to pay Avesco a fee and not run the event because they don't lose as much money from it, then you've got to figure that there's going to be some serious contemplation into that scenario.
Yes, that's right. And the Western Australian government taking a very clear stand and explaining the justification for their decision really does add fuel to that debate. In particular, the very objective criteria that the Western Australian government use, they want a payoff of, I think it was $5 for every dollar that they spent. So $5 worth of motel bookings and restaurant sales and just value to the community for every dollar that they spend on hosting that event. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of debate about what the Australian, what the ACT government uses as their threshold test for events such as that.
Well, just to let you know, we'll do a quick whip around of other events that have happened this weekend. It was the Brazilian who broke his drac as Wilson scored the championship. That's right, Ricardo Serpico won the 10th round of the FIA Formula 3000 Championship at Spa-Francorchamps yesterday, but Justin Wilson wrapped up the title with a second place on the day. Wilson, the Nordic driver, was short of the title when his only rival, Australia's Mark Webber, crashed heavily in the Eau Rouge complex on the opening lap. Webber clipped the damp curve, which sent his Supernova car flying into a tread wall at high speed. The Aussie limped away from the car, but was thought to be seriously injured. Now, I've spoken to Ann Neal quite recently, who was with Alan Webber. Mark has already gone back to England, but Ann has assured us that it was ligament damage that's happened to Mark. He has had quite a hectic schedule, and really that might have played a factor in him not being able to finish off this Formula 3000 championship as well as he would have liked. Obviously, he wanted to win the championship. He now sees his teammate in the team is now Thomas Eng. He's now equal with Mark on points in second position. But what has been quite a constant battle for Mark all season is he has been the Benetton test driver and also racing the Formula 3000. Now, what happened this weekend is a classic example of how busy he's been. He was testing 4 days at the Spanish circuit, Barcelona. He missed the Thursday setup practice session with the Formula 3000 team because he was still in Spain testing the Formula 1 car. So then he comes straight back for qualifying, qualifies fifth, and then has the off in the race because he's just not comfortable. And whilst Formula 3000 is the feeder series to Formula 1, the cars are certainly quite technologically different. So whilst he's not making excuses for having an off, he had an off because he tried too hard, and that was his mistake. It was certainly it's certainly been a difficult year for him, and possibly he's tried to do too much in this year.
What a tough decision to make. Have the opportunity to drive the pinnacle of motorsport 4 days in a Formula One car to prove your worth to the team and try to cement your position for next year versus concentrating on the feeder series. Yeah, it's a tough decision to make. And perhaps, in future, drivers will draw some clearer boundaries saying, look, Formula 3000, I need to win that title for my career, and they'll put some limits on their Formula 1 time.
Well, I don't think so. I think that he's won 3 races this year, but his testing time, he has been testing as quick as anyone else in the team. Jenson Button is doing some more testing. I think it must be at Barcelona again next week, and in fact, because I was asking if Mark was going to take the full 2 weeks to recuperate, and Anne and Alan had indicated to me that they're planning that Mark will be back in the Formula One car on Friday as part of that test session.
Oh, there you go, back in the Formula One testing. And yes, everyone in Australia, of course, has their fingers crossed to see Mark Webber in a proper Formula One drive for next season. That would really get this season off to a kick in Melbourne to see an Australian on the grid.
Now, we also have been following the Australian Rally Championship. Possum Bourne, as you heard earlier in the show, has wrapped up both championships. Has wrapped up the championship and taken out both heats in the Rally of Melbourne. What's that, the Aussie Duck 2001 Rally of Melbourne. In the 10 heats that make up the Super Series, Bourne has won all but one. Only a broken strut in Western Australia saw Neil Bates take the heat win to prove his dominance of an incredible 2000 model Impreza World Rally car, claiming both heats in Melbourne. He also assured co-driver Craig Vincent of a fifth championship. In similar dominant style, Cody Crocker has scooped the double for Subaru, streaking ahead of the Mitsubishi Evette Ordinski to register his fourth straight Group N championship. So a fairly impressive display right throughout the weekend by both Cody Crocker and also Possum Bourne. And, we really do hope that some things can get worked out to make certainly the pinnacle of Australian rallying a little bit more competitive next season.
Yes, you have to take your hats off to Possum Bourne Motorsport. They really are a class outfit, and the results speak for themselves. They have really dominated the sport, and unfortunately it has been to the detriment of the sport. Sport needs competition up front, and Australian rallying really is at a crossroads now. What do they do to the rules for next year and the years beyond to try to get it more competitive at that pointy end? Group N is pretty competitive at the moment. Cody Crocker has won the championship, but at least he had to fight for it. Possum Bourne having such a dominant run really does undermine some of the idea of it being a sport. So it will be very interesting to see what comes of what the rule changes.
All right, next weekend on the show, we'll be obviously talking about Pro Cars venture down to Winton. Oh, yeah, Avesco are there too, aren't they? We'll also have the Mazda Raceway Laguna at Laguna Seca for the American Le Mans Series, where the season winding down sees the Monterey Sports Car Championship in only two races remaining in this championship, and Laguna Seca, the Monterey Sports Car Championship, presented by Mazda, will bring all the ALMS stars back onto the racetrack once again. Of course, Australia's own David Brabham has won two out of the last three starts, Aldi splitting them two races ago. So the Petit Le Mans last weekend was his victory there.
Yes, another Australian performing very well. What else have we got there, Craig?
I was just going to say Jeff Burton went on today to win the Bush Grand National race at the track Too Tough to Tame.
And which one is that?
Darlington, South Carolina, the home of the Darlington Stripe, where the high line is the fastest way around the track. You've got to run it up against the wall and hope that no one is outside you when you go into turn 1 and 3. Of course, 1 and 3 have turned around since that track. It's the oldest super speedway in the United States, and the biggest change at the speedway over the years is that they wanted to put a new grandstand in, so they built a new grandstand on the back stretch and then renamed the stretch.
Yes, that's the way they do it over there. And of course, the famous stripe that Craig refers to is not actually painted on the road or anywhere. It's the marks on the wall that everyone hits.
Well, it's the marks on the wall, and it's also the marks on the side of the car. Quite a bit of carnage in that race. Larry Foyt caned Steve Park in that event, and Steve Park airlifted to hospital. Evidently, he's all right. He was unconscious when the race crew, the racetrack workers found him, and they would have gone, "Oh, not here, please." But the good news was he was conscious, but they kept him overnight. That does put Kenny Wallace, into his car, which is a Dale Earnhardt car that Steve Park, it's a Pennzoil car that Steve Park runs, and that does put him now into the car for tomorrow's racing, because once you've had a head knock, you're not supposed to run at a super speedway the following day.
Yes, a few questions are floating around NASCAR about safety issues, of course, after recent deaths across the last couple of years, and in particular thinking about things of having a crumple zone at the very front of the car. The chassis are a tube type of chassis, not an actual production car type of chassis, and they're remarkably stiff, so all of the impact does get passed through to the only deformable structure, the driver. So they're looking at different ways of having a crumple zone in the very front of the cars, something that they're considering for future years. I understand that they've done some crash tests on a prototype, which did look promising, but there's a lot of tradition in the way they build these things, so they're not willing to change in an awful hurry.
No, they're not going to either. And, of course, they did some testing during the week on the cars at Talladega, which is the next super, super speedway, because it's 2.6 miles around, to try and break up the pack racing. Of course, 1999, the Daytona 500, the cars were single file, and it was quite a boring race for the fans. The drivers enjoyed it, but the fans didn't get to see much passing, and without passing, you really haven't got a motorsport. They put the aero deflector on the roof, and everyone's been quite upset, because now you have 43 cars, three wide in a draft, that is obviously not so safe. If one driver gets out of shape, you've got quite a huge wreck on your hands. So it is a concern, and They have been doing some tests on that before they go back to Talladega. It'll be interesting to see what they work out there.
You know, sort of funny thing at Queensland Raceway last weekend, you always get a giggle when you see a tyre continuing to roll down the straight when it's unattached to the car, and we had that in one of the sports sedan races on Saturday, but what made it double the fun was the actual brake disc was also trundling down the road in equal pace to the wheel, so that was quite entertaining.
Well, you mentioned about wheels falling off the start of the race in the Bush Series today. The car leaving the race was Ryan Newman in the Rusty Wallace, or the Penske Wallace car. He was, they had a red flag situation after a couple of laps where it was raining. They brought the cars down onto pit road. As he was coming down on pit road, his left rear wheel fell off the car. He didn't lose a lap. Because they were in the pit lane, they couldn't. The car sat there for a half an hour rain delay whilst the rain delay was on, red flag conditions. Waved the yellow flag, they pulled the car into the pit bay, changed the tyre, and he got back on his way. I think he finished fifth overall at the end of the race.
Welcome to the Honda Champ Car Update. I'm Jim Murphy. Join me now as we make a visit to the fast-paced world of the kart series.
The Motorola 220 was one of the most bizarre kart race weekends in recent memory. While Bruno Junqueira came away with his career-first kart win, the story goes much deeper. Qualifying started off under rainy skies, with Mamo Gidley setting the provisional pole from the slow group of qualifiers. When the fast group went out, the rains continued and the track got wetter, dampening hopes of improved times. However, with time running out, the track dried, allowing the cars to make one final flying lap as the checkered flag flew, with Kenny Brack coming away with the pole.
In these conditions, you can help the car a little bit, but it's really more of a matter of finding the line where it's the most grip. And went out, and we planned everything pretty good, because we were one of the last cars on the track, and we really waited a long time, and then we went for it. And so happened that we went to... took the pole, so that was a great run.
Brack was also in the news this weekend as he announced he will be leaving Team Rahal in 2002 and has signed with Target Chip Ganassi Racing. During the race, rain was once again a factor. The start was delayed 10 minutes while crews worked to remove pooling water on the circuit. However, despite starting the race under the caution, a river of water continued to pour across the backstretch. First, Max Wilson hit the back of Brian Herta, flying over the top of Herta's car in the water, nearly hitting Herta on the head. Then after the track began to dry and slick tires were the order of the day, Mauricio Guzman and Tora Takagi spun in the same place on the track, bringing out the red flag so officials could tend to the circuit. 45 minutes later, the race continued, but soon thereafter came a frightening moment. Mamo Gidley approached the Billy Mitchell Bridge and lost the back end of the car. Swerving, he ran headlong into the bridge abutment, demolishing his car and sending it tumbling inverted into the grass. Anxious minutes passed, with everyone fearing the worst as safety crews worked on the scene before the word finally came that Gidley was alert and awake. Ultimately, Gidley was driven to the hospital for a full evaluation with nothing more severe than bruised knees and a possible concussion. When the race restarted, the field was split in fuel strategy, with the race coming down to a timed event. Adrian Fernandez looked to have the fuel strategy down pat with just enough to make it to the end, but he didn't have the fuel to race with the leaders, finishing third before running out of methanol on the cool-down lap.
Very difficult because, track conditions were changing constantly, and, you didn't know where your car was going to be. So really, after the red flag, I was pretty happy because my car has been very quick, and I had a good dive with Michael at the beginning of the race there, and then, of course, there came some other yellows. And we had a strategy there where, with Peter, I was on the back, so we took the last pit there to make the full fuel on the tank. And then after that, John didn't know if we were going to go by time race or by lap. So he said, just be patient and just keep saving fuel because, this may turn into a time race. And at the end, because of where we were running, it was it was the right call. I couldn't fight at the end with Michael or with Bruno because of fuel. I ran out in turn two, so that's how close was it for us.
Michael Andretti was making move on Christian Fittipaldi for the lead in turn five when Christian Fittipaldi chopped down, making hard contact. Fittipaldi's day ended with damage, while Michael Andretti continued on. However, it was Bruno Junqueras slipping past, relegating Andretti to a second-place finish.
Unbelievable day. Tough conditions at the start. I'm glad I wasn't Chris Neifel. That was a really difficult thing to do. I mean, I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have done exactly what he did. Basically, all the problems were because guys were going to slicks, and when they were hitting that spot, it was just too much for slicks, and that's why they were crashing. So it was a bit self-inflicted, I think, some of those accidents. So, but it was just a tough situation. And then at the start, Scott Dixon knocked me to the back again, and I thought, well, maybe this is a good omen. You know, maybe it's going to be like Toronto. Actually, as it ended up, it almost happened. But I think Christian Fittipaldi basically made it not happen. When I was going to pass him, I was right alongside of him, and he just flat out turned in on me. And we banged wheels, and that's when Bruno was able to pass me, and that was it. I think had I stayed ahead of Bruno, I don't believe he could have passed, maybe because we were both similar speed. We were both running right together, and I think I was actually a little quicker than him. So it was a little frustrating at that point, but after the way this day went, I'll take second anyway. It's great to do it with Motorola, you know, with our team sponsor sponsoring the race, and to be able to come and have a good result and move up another spot in the championship, which was good.
Junqueras was able to open up enough of a lead that when he pitted for a final splash of fuel, he was able to rejoin the race just in front of Andretti, securing the win.
I think the race was really difficult for me. After the restart, I passed an Andretti, but he passed me again and lost a lot of positions. I went almost on the back of the field. But then I think my team target, Lola Toyota, was very good. I could pass people and start to go forward, and when I had like free track in front of me, I just tried to push and go fast as I could, doing very good lap times, and I built up a gap that I could do a splash and go and return in front of Adrian, and that's it. I'm really happy to win the race.
So here's how they finished at the Motorola 220 at Road America. It was Bruno Junqueras over Michael Andretti and Adrian Fernandez. Rookie Scott Dixon and Gilles Deferrin round out the top five. Then it was Cristiano Damata, Elio Castroneves, Alex Tagliani, Patrick Carpentier, and Oriol Servia in the top 10. Roberto Moreno, Tony Kanaan, Alex Zanardi, Kenny Breck, and Shinji Nakano make up the first 15. 16th through 20th, Max Pappas, Michelle Jordan Jr., Christian Fittipaldi, Dario Franchitti, and Memo Gidley. 21 through 25, Jimmy Vassar, Toru Takagi, Maurizio Gruselman, Brian Herta, and Max Wilson. Rounding out the 26-car field, Paul Tracy. The time of the race, 2 hours, 0 minutes, 28.453 seconds, an average speed of 90.721 miles an hour. The margin of victory, 2.687 seconds. Elio Castroneves came into the weekend 1 point behind Kenny Breck, dropping to 2 back when Breck took the pole on Saturday. However, Kenny failed to score points when Elio came in 7th, securing Castroneves his first series championship lead of his career. Castroneves now has a 5-point advantage, 110-105 over Brack. Gilles Deferrin now sits 3rd with 99, while Michael Andretti moves into 4th with 89. Scott Dixon moves past Dario Franchitti into 5th in the championship. Next up for the FedEx Championship Series is the Molson Indy Vancouver in 2 weeks.
Each week, the Honda Champ Car Update brings you the latest news from the world of karts, straight from the track and directly from the driver's mouth. This internet experience is brought to you by the folks at Honda. Racing is part of who Honda is, and you can see that by visiting www.hondaracing.com.
It has been another interesting weekend in motorsport. Next weekend, as we said, we will have coverage of all the action down at Winton, a bit more from John Davison on the Sandown 500, and, I would imagine they will be certainly hotting up our coverage of Rally of New Zealand.
Yes, looking forward to all of that and more next week on Inside Motorsport.
Inside Motorsport is produced by Thunder Media in the studios of Triple S FM Canberra via Comrade Sat with the support of the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia.